Hey everyone, welcome to New School Critics. This is a Chris episode. I'm Chris, and today I'm going to be talking about the book Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov. And this is actually a pretty important book for me, as it had a huge part in shaping how I feel as a critic specifically, and also just my thoughts on art and how to approach art. I have a bit of a long history with this book, not even a long history, but a significant history. So when I was in college, I was an English major, which probably isn't surprising as everything about me screams he's an English major. Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. And in your senior year, you had to do a capstone course. And my capstone was modernist literature. And the cool part about the class was that you had no assignments other than your final project, which was, in our case, a critical introduction to a text, you know, as if we were writing the introduction to a Penguin book or something like that. And it was supposed to prove that we could be scholars and give us that taste of professional flair. So the class was fascinating because I didn't read any of the books while in the class, but I would go back and read them after I graduated, and they were all amazing. Day of the Locusts and Miss Lonely Hearts by Nathaniel Hawthorne, I think it is, was one that we were supposed to read. Their Eyes Were Watching God was another one. And then we had to pick the book that we wanted to write the critical introduction about, and I picked Pale Fire because it was the weirdest one, and I think he said the most difficult to understand. And I had that ego that was just like, oh, I can do it. I gotta say, it was really weird, but I didn't read the book. That was also the thing that, it's one of my favorite college stories, that I wrote a 20-page critical introduction, got an A on it, and didn't actually read the book. And the professor hated me, so he had no reason to give me an A. I just want to read the opening page. It's two paragraphs, real fast, because I think it gives some context to why this stood out to me, and it'll transition us into talking about the broader things. So the title of the paper was The Slide of and to Mount Vladimir, Welcome to Pale Fire Park. And yeah, I wrote this in 2008, so bear with me if it's a little rough at points. It's been, I was just a bright-eyed 22-year-old, 21-year-old. Okay, but how epic of a title, The Slide of and to Mount Vladimir, Welcome to Pale Fire Park. Yeah. By researching the life, works, and critical analysis of Vladimir Nabokov in order to write this introduction, I feel in a very strange way as if a bond has developed, reminiscent to Kimbo vis-a-vis Shade, but considerably less invasive and fanatical, a feeling I imagine all Nabokov scholars and critics share. Nabokov was, by all accounts, a unique individual with a unique history and a unique cluster of hobbies and interests. In a general sense, much the opposite of one John Shade, who was, in an urban way, a modern hermit, a stay-at-home who left his domicile to teach and to take an occasional stroll. While it's impossible for me to strategically arrange myself to check upon Nabokov as Kimbo did upon Shade, invoking the image of a checked king in chess, I find myself fascinated by the man and wishing I had the opportunity to talk with him in order to uncover all the treasures buried within the pages of Pale Fire. Ah, oh, how good is that? So that was the first paragraph. And then after 46 years of critics taking shovel in hand, checking their maps, and trying to find some giant X in the text, many debates still rage with intense heat over topics ranging from authorial ownership of the foreword, poem, commentary, and index, to the appearance and influence of ghosts and specters, to how many of the connections are coincidence or Nabokov's sheer brilliance. No one has a definitive answer, and I doubt any ever will. Nevertheless, whether you are a first-time reader or rereading Nabokov's El Dorado, it is the depth of the relationship amongst every element of the story, the interconnectedness of worlds and words and characters, the reader included, which seem apparent yet cannot be so readily explained, that makes this book intriguing and unlike anything else. So I just bullshitted all of that because, again, I hadn't read the book. I read the foreword and maybe the poem, but not the commentary. And it's probably a strange sentence if you don't know anything about Pale Fire, but a bit of a reminder. Pale Fire is this avant-garde work where Nabokov was at a point in his career where he could write a novel as great as anybody could write a novel, but he decided that he wanted to make the novel into a puzzle, into a game, to challenge the reader to piece things together in a way that would delight them when they could finally figure it out. But he would leave little clues, and it wasn't so clear when you finished the first read what happened, why it happened. There just felt like you were missing bits and pieces. So in this text, how it's broken up into the foreword, poem, commentary, and index, there's little clues in each one that hint at what the true story is. And the story, just generally, is that the book takes on, it's kind of meta in the sense that the book is supposed to be a text, a scholarly work by this guy, Charles Kimboat, who is doing a critical commentary on a poem by this guy, John Shade. So the foreword is by Kimboat and is the foreword to his critical commentary and to the poem. So you get the foreword, the poem by John Shade, and then the commentary by Kimboat, and then an index. So the novel itself is reminiscent of this scholarly work, except the scholar in question, Charles Kimboat, is actually a madman. So the foreword starts off in the way that any academic foreword would, but by the end of it, you're like, oh, this guy's kind of fucking crazy. Oh, okay. And then the poem's really good by John Shade. It's a legitimate poem. And then the commentary is just insanity. And, you know, overall, Nabokov's commenting on the relationship between critics and artists, right? And by positioning the critic as an insane person in this instance, I don't think he's too far off. But it does highlight the nature and kind of the parasitic relationship between the two in a way that I don't know if a lot of texts had up to that point or have since, which is really cool. And I think still lives up to the dynamic to this day, which just shows how constantly a problem that it's been. I have a big, as a critic, I have a big issue with critics as well. But the main crux that really stood out to me and that was fascinating to me was that a bunch of scholars disagreed about what was going on in this book. So apparently there was one group that decided that Kimbo wrote everything, right? That he wasn't the madman that he seemed, that he wrote the foreword and the poem and the commentary and the index as this meta work, and he's actually this great guy. Then other scholars were like, nah, he wrote it all, but he is a madman. He's just a madman that would write all of this. And then there was a whole other group that thought that John Shade wrote everything, that Kimboat was just this commentary on the critic, that Shade was the poet that the story said that he was, and this was just a grand work by him. And then there were others that had other theories about Shade, but essentially it came down to, did you believe that it was as the story claims it to be, that Kimboat's writing the foreword and commentary, and that Shade wrote the poem? Do you believe that Kimboat wrote everything, or do you believe that Shade wrote everything? And there were little clues throughout the text that people pointed to as like, this is a clear sign that Kimboat wrote it all. This is a clear sign that Shade wrote it all. And at one point, Nabokov came out and said that, nah, it was Shade. Shade wrote it all. I believe that's what he said. You might need to correct me. It's been a little bit of time. It was either that or he just said, it is what it is. Like, Kimboat didn't write the poem. Shade didn't write the commentary. Like, it's just face value. Take it at face value. But the scholars even rejected that, which got into a whole other debate. So you had the initial debate about the text itself, and then this secondary debate about whether or not Nabokov's statement about the work actually had any weight whatsoever, because there were critics and readers that were just like, oh, that's it. Like, he told us how it is, so that's the definitive way of reading it. And then others that said, no, No. It doesn't matter what the artist wanted to do or thinks that they did. It only matters what's there. And if they wrote it in a way where you can have multiple interpretations, then the multiple interpretations exist, which was such a fascinating topic to me. And it's still something that I think about all the time. And it's something that's on my mind whenever I do any kind of critical analysis, whether that's in these YouTube videos, our Kanye podcast, Watching the Throne, the articles I write for Forbes, writing my own fiction and short stories. I'm constantly thinking about the role of the author and does it matter what they intended or not? And that's so fascinating to me because it is a strange debate. The example I like to go back to is, I mean, imagine if George R. R. Martin came out and said that Game of Thrones is about 9/11. What? Wait, Game of Thrones is about 9/11? Like, how would that even process or make sense? You're supposed to put everything that happens in Game of Thrones in context of 9/11. That would just kind of be absurd. I mean, you could maybe start to make connections between the two. Not to get into too many spoilers about Game of Thrones, but there's a big event near the end where you're like, oh, could that be the similarity? I guess, maybe, but what a hard thing to try to convince somebody on. And likewise, you could look at Stephen King saying that It is actually about, I don't know, like childbirth. Yeah. That wouldn't make any sense either. So that's why scholars would argue that authorial intent could be problematic, because the author could think that they're pulling something off, but is that really there? It's the kind of thing where a writer might say, oh, did you understand that when she clutched her red sweater, it actually meant that she was thinking about her grandma because her grandma often sat in the red chair? You're just like, what? So because she had a red sweater and she held it, I'm supposed to think of her grandma sitting in a red chair? Like, no, that doesn't work, because you didn't lay it out in the story enough to make that connection. Where the author might write something where the grandma wears red, has a red scarf, and then at the end, this girl has the scarf and it's a different red scarf or something and holds it. And you're like, oh, there's a connection there. She's thinking about her grandma. And the author could say, no, I had no intention of that whatsoever. She just needed a scarf and I own a red scarf. Do you listen to the author in that case, or do you make the connection that's there because it's there in the subtext? Such a debate. And there's going to be people that clearly feel one way about it, clearly feel another way about it. One of the fascinating moments that actually happened to me regarding that was I got to interview, I always forget his name. It's the guy that directed Drive and Only God Forgives and Neon Demon. It's big enough that I should remember his name, but I got to interview him, and I noticed that Only God Forgives used a lot of blue and red light, like really like strong blue and red lighting throughout, and that Neon Demon also did the same thing. And I ended up asking him when I got to interview him, like, did you do that on purpose to kind of thematically connect the two, or to make the viewer that knows your filmography look at the two movies as being related in some capacity? And he kind of gave me a weird look and was just like, I'm colorblind. So red and blue are really the only colors I can respond to, so I use them. Oh, okay. So that was one of those instances where, okay, no subtext whatsoever, but because he used that in those movies and there are similarities, people could start to build themes or build arguments about how to read those two movies as being in tandem to one another. Whether or not it was purposeful or not, this was still elements in there. And that gets into the unconscious aspect of artistic creation. A writer might deny saying that this story is about their relationship with their parents, but that might be due to the fact that they can't see or don't want to admit, because of the baggage and guilt that they have, that what they wrote or created has to do with their parents. Like, there's things like that that manifest that they don't necessarily intend or mean to, but that is clearly affecting the work. And that's just life in general. We're all kind of influenced and impacted by these unconscious elements that stress us out, guilt us, that we're longing for, wishing for. And that's why the question of authorial ownership and authorial intent is such a complicated one. And that's one of the things that makes Pale Fire such a interesting text and really like a gateway into the meta scholarly world of a work. Because on the one hand, if you just read this book, that's it. It's an interesting book. It's a challenging book. It does some cool things, but ultimately at the end of the day, you just kind of leave it be. But then when you start looking into the larger discussions around the book, there's a whole narrative and story there that's really, at least to me, fascinating. And I think you can get into other elements that are like that. Like if somebody started making a documentary or a commentary about everything that's happened from Making a Murderer or Tiger King, right? That there's all this ancillary story outside of the work itself that becomes fascinating. And even wrestling, to a certain degree at this point, people don't just enjoy the wrestling aspect anymore. Fans are as addicted to the drama and gossip behind the scenes and what's going on behind the scenes as they are what's actually part of the entertainment or story. So there's a whole meta world to get into with any work that starts to get pretty dynamic. And if you are interested in doing that in literature, Pale Fire is a very good place to start. The book is up my alley in terms of how strangely put together it is, and probably has been a bit of a negative influence on my own writing because I wanted to jump and start doing the things that Nabokov was doing before being at the level that Nabokov was in order to do it. But this modal, deconstructed way of telling the story where you're switching perspectives, you're making it like a novel. It is a novel, but the novel's imitating not a novel is a really fascinating aspect that I just love. The poem Pale Fire by John Shade is really cool too. And the book actually ends up reminding me a lot of Infinite Jest. And I never actually thought about the two being connected, but Infinite Jest is this huge, giant text, and every pretentious person's like dream book to reference that you read it, but it also makes use of ghosts and weird happenings and has unfinished aspects to the story that in order to understand them or find the conclusion to them, you have to go back and discover these little moments. Whether that's in the actual text itself, where chapters are a little out of order at the beginning, or in the index that it has that's also like 200 pages. So kind of fascinating that both books get a little bit metaphysical while also having indexes that they use for this commentary and jokes. Huh, I never really thought about that. But Pale Fire's story does have this subplot maybe of John Shade's daughter or son dying and being a ghost in the house and affecting things in the house as she tries to prevent the death of her father by Charles Kimboat. Some weird stuff goes on where you could completely miss that and just get the story as is or delve deeper into the index and these little lines in the poem that indicate something more and take away this whole other story. So it's fascinating that, I keep using fascinating, but it is fascinating that Nabokov was at the level where he could provide enough little clues and context areas here and there throughout to give people vastly different interpretations of why things happened and just laying those breadcrumbs in a broad enough way, still specific, but broad enough that people could try to jump to a conclusion and make it work, generally speaking. So that's one of the real strengths of this book, is just the masterful nature of knowing how much information to provide and where to provide it. And the writing is really beautiful as well. Nabokov spoke three languages. He lived, I think it was Russia, and then America. He was in Russia for 20 years, in America for 20 years, and then went to Switzerland, I think, for 20 years. and he always described his life as a spiral. And so he started writing in Russian, then in English, and had great command of the English language, but he had this poetry that he could bring to the phrasing and the descriptions based on picking up English, not as his native language, but in context to having the Russian foundation. Really beautiful and thought-provoking language throughout the book, while also getting into this bizarre and strange characterization of Kimboat. So you're getting something that's at once scholarship, as once human deconstruction and psychosis, as well as an elaborate game laid out by one of the best novelists of the 20th century. So it's interesting to read a text that's about somebody that's so insane, written by somebody that's so genius, and the tension that exists between knowing that there's this genius writing these words and playing this game on you, the reader, while also experiencing the insanity of this character. The dynamic there between the facsimile of it all and the machinations of it all that are just for the game versus really getting into the story, that's a delicate balance, because if you focus too much on the game, it could make the story feel hollow. And if you focus too much on the story, you could lose track of the game. I don't know. I love that he could be that bizarre with the text. And then I'm pretty sure now inspire something like Infinite Jest. And that's another book that does it so well. I don't know if House of Leaves, I haven't read that. But that's another one that kind of makes the game, or makes a game out of the text. And Nabokov had a few books that were like that, that just started getting into how can I make this like chess for the reader. Big fan of the work, and big fan of just the discussion about the work. Yeah, you can see on the Wikipedia page all the interpretations and all the back and forth and debates. That's in the video, though. If you're listening to the podcast, just go to the Wikipedia page and you can see that there's a ton going on there, and just a ton of allusions and references. Like, it is a deep, thought-provoking book that you can continuously go back to. And that's one of the cool things too, that he was writing on a level to where you could just read it and get an enjoyment without ever diving into anything more. But then if you really want to dive into it, there just, it feels endless amounts of content or thoughts that you could have about this text. So highly recommended giving it a shot. And if you do, or you have read it and want to discuss, you know, leave a comment on the YouTube channel or hit me up at Kanye Podcast on Twitter, or send an email to newschoolchris@gmail.com. And if you want to help us out, the easiest way on YouTube is just to like, subscribe, or comment. It tells YouTube that this is a channel people are enjoying and engaging with, and then they show it to more. If you're listening via the podcast version, then just leaving a review on iTunes is probably the most beneficial. And then we also have a Patreon, that's patreon.com/Kanye Podcast, and you can also subscribe via Anchor and support us for, you know, 99 cents a month. All of that's appreciated. And if you have any requests, happy to hear them. Until next time, I'm Chris, and this has been New School Critics.